Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Konser. This week, in honor of the late historian and philosopher Howard Zinn, author of the book A People's History of the United States, we're bringing you a vintage interview featuring Zinn's artistic collaborator Mike Konopacki. Konopacki, a longtime labor cartoonist, joined us in July of 2008 to talk about A People's History of American Empire, the graphic adaptation that he co-created with Zinn and fellow historian Paul Buell. Now, before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's all-important fall membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our special programming featuring the theme Sounds of Democracy, and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Because we're still being cautious and not yet opening up our studios, we don't have volunteers in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for nearly 18 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give. Or if you like, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now, Mike Konopacki, recorded on July 28th, 2008. On the line, we have Mike Konopacki, who is the artist behind the new Howard Zinn book, The People's History of American Empire. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you for having me.
And this is an interesting project. This is a graphic history of a chapter in Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States. And this is the chapter that deals with empire.
Well, it's based on chapter 12, which is called The Empire and the People. But it goes from the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890, and the book ends with the Iraq War.
This is a pretty troubling chapter in all, as far as American history goes, because, of course, this country was founded ideally on the principle that there's one person, one vote, self-determination, no taxation without representation. And then at the end of the 19th century, we started moving into places like Cuba and the Philippines and saying, well, we're the ones who are determining your future and how things go.
Well, it's a complex story because expansionism westward was the internal empire being conquered. And so manifest destiny basically meant that anybody who stood in the way, namely, you know, the native tribes, were going to be conquered in order for the United States to grow from the East Coast to the West Coast. So empire really begins with the interior empire, and once we've conquered the continent of the United States, then they started thinking of themselves as going beyond the continental borders.
And there's certainly some recent history in here as well. There's a chapter on the overthrowing of Mossadegh and democracy in Iran. On KBOO here, we had Marjan Satrapi, the author of Persepolis, the graphic novel about the Iranian Revolution. We had her on the show, and that situation continues today, certainly, the terrible outgrowth of our adventurism in Iran.
Well, and that's why that chapter is so significant, because the story of the overthrow, which was masterminded by Kermit Roosevelt, who is the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, laid the groundwork for what's been going on in the Middle East today with Iran and Iraq, and all had to do with the control of oil. And oil was basically the fuel of empire, and in those days it was the fuel of the British Empire. In the research that we had to do for that particular chapter, we found this fascinating photo of Mossadegh touching the crack in the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. And I found that in a book by Stephen Kinzer called All the Shah's Men, and it's in the epilogue. And so When I Googled Mosaddegh and Liberty Bell, this thing came up, and it was on the Truman Library website, and so it was in the public domain, and we were allowed to use it. And I thought it was the most striking example of what kind of respect he had for the idea of democracy and what kind of disrespect we had for the Iranian effort to have a democratic parliament and to get rid of the Shah.
Well, this is interesting because Mosaddegh is certainly not the only person that the U.S. government has been at odds with who's had a real admiration for the Enlightenment thinking of American authors in the 1770s, Thomas Paine and all. If I'm not mistaken, Fidel Castro had a fascination with the United States in his youth. Ho Chi Minh was also interested in the works of Thomas Paine.
Right. And when the United States saw that the Spanish Empire was in decline and they thought that they were ripe for the plucking, in the chapter on the Spanish-American War or the invasion of Cuba, we talk about Antonio Maceo, who was a black general in the revolution, the Cuban Revolution against the Spanish. So again, these are the people's history stories. So those stories are all told from the point of view of the people. And so Maceo tells the story of how the United States conquered Cuba, liberated the Cubans from the Spanish, but not from us. And then the chapter on the Philippine War, which is the most striking because the parallels between what we did in the Philippines and what we're doing today in Iraq are amazing parallels.
And Cuba and the Philippines were significant, especially because those were the first major steps into taking other sovereign nations under our wing as the U.S. and, you know, not releasing them after we said we would.
Well, the Philippines was called the stepping stone to the Asian market. So it was all about expanding markets. And so if they had their hands on the Philippines, then they had their, they had an inroad into the China market. And again, China has a major impact on the American economy, and it's kind of become the manufacturing plant for the United States.
And this was a century ago when that was first realized.
Correct. So the Philippine section is important because there were a group of Filipino professors and academics in San Francisco that came out with a book called The Forbidden Book, and it's a collection of American political cartoons from the late 1890s to the early 1900s about the takeover of the Philippines. And the story is really an untold story, and Howard deals with it in his book. And so this book expands on that, and we talk about torture that they used during the Philippine War. Back then it was called the water cure instead of waterboarding. It was the same kind of thing. And the Filipinos, Emilio Aguinaldo is the revolutionary president who his army defeated the Spanish army, and they had written their own constitution. They had studied other constitutions. They based their constitutions somewhat on ours and on other models that they felt were going to be very successful. And the United States just decided, well, no, you're going to belong to us. And so all the democratic efforts that the Filipinos made to become an independent republic, not under the thumb of an empire, we were frustrated by the United States because it was the stepping stone to the Asian market.
Now, you bring up a good point because some listeners might think of a comics version of a people's history of the United States as being somewhat frivolous. But in fact, political cartooning has a long tradition of being at the forefront of American revolutionary change. And in fact, if you look at the first colonial flags of the Patriots before the American Revolution really got going, a lot of those are cartoons. Join or Die, Don't Tread on Me.
Join or Die was a political cartoon engraved by Benjamin Franklin in, I think it was 1749. And that was a way of communicating. And so I think, you know, we're getting some criticism for the look of the book because it's too cartoony, but the whole thing of it is that it's a political book, and political cartooning, I think, fits into that genre. And it also gives us a little bit of freedom because we can do some satirical stuff. We can do very serious stuff. You know, I think that it gives a whole lot of freedom to the cartoonist to draw something like this.
Yeah, you do walk a fine line in this book between depicting these historical characters in a straightforward way and sometimes being cartoony, especially in the activities that happen.
Right, and then whenever I depict a U.S. president, I like to turn him into a caricature, just like I would if I'm dealing with a U.S. president today. So, again, I mean, there's that kind of freedom that cartooning gives you so that you don't... I mean, I'm not very good at realism anyway, but the idea of cartooning... I mean, that goes, you can use Mouse as an example, because Art Spiegelman actually did the book based on animal characters.
And this was a book about the Holocaust in Germany.
Yeah, and how serious, you know, how much more serious can you get than that?
I'm S.W. Konser, and you're listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, featuring labor cartoonist Mike Konopacki. Konopacki joined us in July of 2008 to talk about A People's History of American Empire, the book that he co-created with historians Howard Zinn and Paul Buell.
Let's talk a little bit about the original Howard Zinn book, A People's History of the United States. This came out in 1980. It has been revised and sold a couple of million copies in something like 17 different languages. It's become a mainstay of American history courses in universities. There have been spin-offs such as Voices of a People's History.
Right, and Voices was the source material. So these are the original documents that Howard relied on when he was writing A People's History. And so when we put this book together, we used all of this source material. For example, Mark Twain explaining the Moro Massacre is taken directly from Voices of a People's History. So we try to use the original source material as much as possible.
Yeah, the People's History was famous for bringing in voices of working class people, not major historical figures. But also, it's interesting that you mentioned Mark Twain. Whenever remembrances of Mark Twain are done in modern day history, we see him as a humorist, as a novelist, but certainly not as an anti-imperialist, which he was. He despised the European colonialization of Africa. And Dr. Martin Luther King, we see in the book People's History of the American Empire, him speaking out against the Vietnam War, saying social progress is ignored when the guns of war become a national obsession.
Well, and Howard has written an essay about what I didn't learn in high school, and a lot of it has to do with the reason he wrote A People's History was that he didn't find these stories. He didn't see these stories in his high school textbooks, so he had to write them himself.
Now, how did this project come about? We started out with Howard Zinn's textbook, A People's History of the United States, and you were called up by a professor, Paul Buell, who was helping Howard Zinn launch a project, and this was the project that became A People's History of American Empire.
That's correct, and I guess my history as a labor cartoonist for the last 25 years had something to do with why he called me and asked if I'd be interested in doing such a project. And of course, when somebody asks you to do something with Howard Zinn, it's hard to say no. But the project then, the complexity of the project then became quite apparent, because how do you take something that's very dense? There's a lot of nuance. I mean, Howard's book is full of information. How do you convert that from a history book to a comic where you're required to boil everything down to its essence and get it as sharp of writing as you possibly can? And so I tried to write some of these stories, and I was having a heck of a time. And so a friend of mine who is a retired labor writer, her name is Kathy Wilkes, and she used to be the communications director for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.
The Pals Book Union here in Portland.
The Pals Book Union, that's right. And Kathy and I kind of sat down and put all this stuff together, and she edited this thing so tightly and used it in such economic language that I think it serves the comic book format beautifully.
Now, the thread of the story in the graphic version of A People's History of American Empire, has Howard Zinn introducing more recent struggles such as the Iraq War, and then going back through history. And the interesting part is that Howard Zinn is so strongly a part of 20th century history himself when so many of these issues were taking place. He was a professor at the primarily black Spelman College, for example, during the civil rights movement and created a lot of controversy then. He was, in fact, a bombardier in World War II. And there's one chapter here where he finds out that he's just dropped napalm over France when the Germans are already leaving. And here he is looking very forlorn, saying, "I was just following orders. It is the ancient cry of the warrior who has committed atrocities."
Well, see, that's why his story, by incorporating it into the book, it's like, here's the son of immigrant workers who grows up within the American Empire, and he becomes part of it during World War II, but then the rest of his life is spent dealing with that and becoming active in movements, especially the civil rights movement, as you mentioned. And then, of course, he was active against the Vietnam War, so we include a story about the Pentagon Papers where Howard and Daniel Ellsberg were close friends at the time, and Howard actually helped keep a copy of the Pentagon Papers in his apartment when Ellsberg was being sought out by the police. So he appears within all of these stories because he was actually there and he was actually involved in it. And I think that makes him, you know, he's really a rich character. And I think that that's why having his personal story in the book is so important.
He's sort of the superhero of this comic.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, if it has to be a superhero comic, then Howard Zinn is the superhero. Well, see, what we really tried to do with the book is Howard has got a great sense of humor. He doesn't take himself seriously at all. And, you know, he has a very serious subject that he's dealing with, but he also has a lot of self-deprecating humor. And we tried to get more Howardisms, we called them, into the book. But I think that it's important to have that sense of humor, and that's why we ended the book with the possibility of hope, because you can't just be beaten down, you know, through the whole book and then not feel like there's something that can be done. And I think that the hopeful nature that Howard has, it's important that come through.
Right. Cynicism needs hope to balance it out a little bit. And there is a lot of cynicism. It's very entertaining. And I think a lot of the power of the entertainment comes from your drawings.
Well, thanks.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your art in this, because there are some very careful depictions of figures in world history during the 20th century. In fact, there's a whole lot of photographic
archival photos.
Yeah, there's a wealth of archival photos here, and some beautiful photoshoppery that you did by mixing and matching graphic cartoony elements and historical photography.
Well, the reason we had to print it in black and white so that we couldn't use color, and now that all books are published digitally, I had to prepare the digital file for all of this, and so now Photoshop comes into play, because now I can enhance ink drawings that I would do on tracing paper, scan into the computer, and now I can enhance them in Photoshop. And we can also take archival photos, and I can actually clone a character into a photo, or I can, you know, manipulate that. And this goes back to photo montage during, you know, the Weimar Republic, when the German expressionists and the German Dadaists did this kind of artwork. And I'm a big fan of John Hartfield, who was a master at photo montage. And so I think that some of that is informed by George Grosz's cartoons from the 20s in Germany and from John Hartfield's photo montage.
As opposed to some of the Dadaists, and I'm thinking of folks like Max Ernst, you're fairly subtle, though.
Well, anyway, I mean, it's a difficulty in trying to blend political cartooning, which is a genre in its own, and then take it to the next step, which is sequential art or graphic storytelling. And so I'm also a student of Will Eisner, who has two textbooks on how to do graphic storytelling. And his artwork isn't all realism either. Again, I won't compare myself to Spiegelman or Eisner, but I would look to them to try to find solutions to problems, and they were always very helpful.
It's interesting that so many of the great comics figures of the 20th century are the children of Eastern European immigrants, for example. And oftentimes red diaper babies.
Well, I'm the child of Polish immigrants in Wisconsin, but I'm not a red diaper baby by any means.
But let's talk about your start in political cartoons. You said that Will Eisner influenced you, obviously. Who were some of the other people that influenced you to become a cartoonist with a focus on labor issues?
Well, when I started college in the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1971, it was in the middle of the Vietnam War. Watergate was just beginning, so I kind of cut my teeth on Watergate in Vietnam by doing political cartoons for the student paper, The Daily Cardinal. And one of the discoveries that I made as a student was a cartoonist by the name of Art Young. And he was a cartoonist for a magazine called The Masses in 1911 to 1917 in New York. And Art Young grew up in Monroe, Wisconsin, which is a small town south of Madison. And so I kind of had I was really interested in him just because he was from Wisconsin. But he did the definitive drawings of the Haymarket Martyrs in 1886.
In Chicago, the anarchist group that got railroaded.
And eventually he regretted having been part of the anti-anarchist hysteria, and he became a socialist, and he was one of the leading socialists and cartoonists and humorists during the early part of the 20th century. And his work is very cartoony. It's also uses a lot of cross-hatching. It's very, he's pretty meticulous. And then I discovered through The Masses, people like Robert Minor, who was a great communist labor cartoonist. And I started studying labor cartoons. And my friend Gary Huck, who was the cartoonist for the Racine Labor, which is one of the longest-running weekly labor papers in Racine, Wisconsin, he and I met in the late 70s and realized that we were both doing cartoons for labor unions at the time. I was working for a strike newspaper. And so we started Huck Konopacki Labor Cartoons in 1983.
Now, that strike paper was staffed by journalists who were on strike from the major dailies.
That's right. The Madison Capital Times and the Wisconsin State Journal were the two dailies. And all of the reporters and production unions went on strike. And this was the period where they went from hot type to cold type. So there was an upheaval in the newspaper industry. And Dave Wagner, who was one of the co-writers of this book, was my editor at the time. And I did political cartoons, and he did editorials on the editorial page. And so we called it playing newspaper. We had a lot of fun editorializing, and we scooped some of the dailies during the strike. But I learned all my labor issues from the workers that were on strike back from 1977 to 1980.
And you and Gary Huck have formed a syndicate. You're self-syndicated, so you're not with one of the major cartoon syndicates. And you tend to avoid the daily and weekly newspapers. And your cartoons can be found mostly in labor publications.
That's correct. Yeah, we basically do cartoons for labor unions. So like the Northwest Labor Press in Portland is one of our subscribers. The Washington State Labor Council newspaper uses our cartoons. And we have a number of subscribers in the U.S. and in Canada. And they're all labor union publications. So we need to do people's labor cartoons because we're always talking about the issues of workers. That's one of the reasons why we have labor stories in this particular book, especially my favorite story is when Howard was saying how he never heard anything about the Ludlow Massacre until he heard Woody Guthrie's song.
Huh.
So we took the lyrics of Woody Guthrie's song and we basically illustrated that to tell the story of the Ludlow Massacre. And the Guthrie family was very kind to let us use his lyrics and so we could illustrate his story.
Well, this brings to mind the fact that songs and comics have something very closely in common, and that's that they are, in some cases, the oldest versions of historical storytelling. Songs go back to the pre-literate days when people learned their history through rhyme schemes and simple repetition, and comics go back to the days of the early printing press, when pictures were used to augment words. You showed as well as told.
Right, and it's also a form of folk art, in my estimation. So the folk songs of Woody Guthrie fit right into that kind of thing. I think we're breaking new ground in a certain way, because I think this is a unique form. It's a difficult form because you're trying to tell a complex story in a simplified manner, but I don't think we talk down to anybody. I think it's a very serious project, but it gives it another approach, and I think that this is a great way to tell history.
This is something that people can learn about by going to howardzinn.com. That's howardzinn.com. Well, the book is called A People's History of American Empire. It is a graphic history based on Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, and focused particularly on, well, the United States going out into the world and imposing its rule in other places.
Well, that's right, and it points out the very clear fact that Iraq and Afghanistan are not aberrations, that they're actually part of a continuum that began with the founding of the nation and with Manifest Destiny, and now we're just going into the Middle East.
Well, thank you, Mike Konopacki.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in July of 2008, and featuring labor cartoonist Mike Konopacki, co-author, along with historians Howard Zinn and Paul Buell, of the graphic novel A People's History of American Empire. I'm S.W. Konser. We hope you've been enjoying our special Sounds of Democracy programming for KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give. Or if you like, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.